Campus FM jippreżenta 50 u waħda. L-istorja ta' Malta tul dawn l-aħħar 50 sena minn il-Malta Historical Society. Prezentazzjoni u produzzjoni Sergio Grek. Nsellmilkom nilqgħukom għal programm ieħor, dan huwa t-tielet programm mis-sensiela ta' programmi 50 waħda. Għaliex 50 waħda għaliex qegħdin fil-51 sena mill-kisba tal-indipendenza. 51 sena bladubju interessanti fl-istorja ta' Malta, fl-istorja politika, fl-istorja ekonomika, fl-istorja kostituzzjonali, fl-istorja soċjali. Matul dan il-programmi se jkollna l-opportunità li nisimgħu sensiela ta' lectures ostra li nataw mill-membri kif ukoll minn akkademiċi oħrajn organizzati mill- Malta Historical Society, Soċjetà Storika ta' Malta, Continuity and Change taħdik il-kappa u diversi kelliema ingħataw diversi suġġetti. Illum ser napprezzaw nistgħu ngħidu tnejn oħra minn dawn il-lectures. L-ewwel lecture fil-fatt hija mingħand Michael Fenech fejn se jitkellem dwar il-konservatiżmu, se jitkellem ukoll dwar l-arti, se jitkellem ukoll dwar il-kultura. U għalhekk huwa suġġett interessanti anki dwar il-bżonn ta' ikonna kuraturi li anki jafu jieħdu ħsieb dawk l-affarijiet li aħna nipposjedu bħala nazzjon. Din toħroġ ċara wkoll minn din il-lecture ta' Michael Fenech li riċentament ukoll għadu kemm kiseb MA minn Università Ingliża f'dan is-suġġett. Iktar tard imbagħad inkellmukom dwar it-tieni lecture.
Whereas the generic title of this series of lectures is Change and Continuity, my presentation will take a slightly different approach. In this presentation, I would like to talk about rupture, and particularly about two moments of rupture that have marked the development of art history in Malta and during the last century. This paper is a condensation of two chapters from my dissertation presented as part of the requirements for the award of an MA in Culture Criticism and Curating from the University of the Arts London. I will be highlighting how artists and art managers have reacted to important junctures in the last 70 years. I will base this overview on a variety of published sources and on an extensive series of personal interviews that I conducted with artists and art practitioners and professionals in Malta during between June and October 2013. Blaming history is very convenient. It's an easy scapegoat, as it cannot answer back. But eulogizing history is usually worse, and Maltese art history has had more than its fair share of nostalgic eulogies. I'm quoting the art critic Ray Filvella, who argues that in the popular account, especially in the easy-listening version made up for the delectation of tourists, Maltese history and the development of a Maltese identity is often presented as an inevitable, non-problematic teleological movement, progressing through different colonial eras to constitutional independence and towards integration in the European Union and an enlightened modernity, thereby implying a kind of intrinsic finality. It may be difficult to acknowledge that a small island nation can have so much complexity and layering, giving a context to its unique identity. Claims to uniqueness need to be handled with extreme care. I paraphrase John Baldacchino. Maltese stone is Globigerina limestone, common all around the Mediterranean, as is Maltese bread, pastizzi, lace. Identity, especially as a national generalizing attribute, is always a complex, problematic concept. For it invariably brings into play a plethora of emotions related to self-perception and self-representation. And the inhabitants of Malta only started developing a sense of self-perception and a claim to self-representation relatively recently in their history. During the past 70 years, Maltese artists have been part of a movement across the different branches of the arts, and a movement that has attempted to drag Maltese art out of the prevailing conservatism into mainstream modernity. Ken Twain has proposed three realities for Malta's late introduction into modernism. The first is the geographical reality of isolation and the frontier. Geographical position has had a marked effect on the Maltese's sense of identity as a frontier territory. The populist Maltese narrative has always placed Malta at the frontier of the Western world and hence on the edge of civilization. It is a position characterized by duality. On the one hand, a reaching out for trade, and on the other, an outpost vulnerable to the attention of marauding aggressors. In this Western-centric view, Malta has been portrayed as the vanguard of Catholicism and defender of the faith, ever since the fateful shipwreck of St. Paul and the conversion of its populace. Never mind that much of this narrative relative to St. Paul has been at the base of popularly accepted view of Maltese religious identity, has often been questioned by historians. Malta's long history as a colony has also been extensively researched. The state of subjugation, politically as well as attitudinally, may have resulted in what Professor Wayne calls an exaggerated sense of awe before the foreign. The reign of the Order of the Knights of St. John and the British periods are a good example of the dialectic between political loss and economic and cultural benefit. Over the duration of their stay, the Knights enriched the island economically, artistically, particularly with ecclesiastical and military architecture. But whereas Malta was both a base and a home in which the Knights invested heavily from their own resources and to which they brought the best military and civil architects and artists, the British hardly had any of these ties. The latter invested in defense and services to enhance Malta's function as a service post and a naval base. Whatever the legacy left by the British, in an age of awakening nationalism, the lack of political autonomy rankled. One consequence of the lack of political autonomy throughout the centuries up to 1964 was that the Catholic Church became the only viable and constant corporate representative of the Maltese, a power that commanded their loyalty while seeing to their spiritual needs. The dialectic in which Maltese artists were caught between the 19th and the mid-20th century was that of a conservative church. On the one hand, the church being the major patron and commissioner of artworks, and on the other hand, a strict and powerful standard bearer for tradition, and hence a major obstacle to progress. The reaction from all these artists seems to have been to embrace the establishment. Joseph Paul Cassin has shown how academic art at the start of the last century was concerned with an uncompromising adherence to traditional systems of teaching that concentrated entirely on the study of the human anatomy, the promotion of realism, and the principles of classical harmony, all systems approved by the ecclesiastical authority. Esprit Barthé, for example, an early exponent of modernist abstract art, when interviewed by Cassar, recalls that it took me quite a while to get a feeling for modern styles. The academic discipline that had molded me was very strong. Here we see two treatments, practically the same subject. Some contemporary Maltese artists have attempted to escape the mold of national identity. Norbert Attard, for example, is a prime example of a Maltese artist whose work is no longer conditioned by local issues and who has found his place in international arts community without reference to his nationality. Yet, though Attard is totally integrated in the international art circuit, he still believes that his roots, problematic as they may be, inform his work. And I quote from his artist statements from his website. All artists are the product of their cultural environments. In my case, the key themes may perhaps be traced to my cultural roots in Malta, a Catholic / secular island at the edges of Europe and North Africa. Some of the oppositions are religion, secularism, the relationship between land and sea, polarization of political parties, in short, the exhausting engagement of dualities. Engagement is exhausting, engagement within a cultural environment rich in oppositions and dualities, possibly more so. Why would Maltese artists feel the compulsion to escape or to redefine their Malteseness? Could this be due, in part, to a reaction to a genre of populist artistic events in the 70s and 80s, officially sanctioned and financially supported by the socialist government of the time? Techie rock operas, such as Jensna, provided a saccharine rewriting of history in four nationalistic terms, with stage sets and choreography that imitated the visual narrative of Soviet state-sanctioned art. Identifying epochal shifts and ruptures in recent Maltese art history may help link the present situation to an understanding of the roots feeding contemporary art practices. This soul-searching needs to be placed in the context of a sort of a schizophrenia brought about by the competing pull of the two dominant worldviews of the pre-war time, what is known as the language question. On the one hand, we have the political and practical power of the British Empire as colonizers, and on the other hand, the cultural affinity of Italy, which many intellectuals of the time saw as the cultural, if not natural, home of the Maltese. The establishment of a school of art by Parliament, by Act of Parliament in the 1920s, provided a cohort of competent, if traditional, artists who were reacting to the market conditions of the time. The British colonizers and an emerging business class were, unlike the knights before them, not exactly known for their cutting-edge tastes in art. And Maltese artists seem to have survived by producing low-key genre painting, such as portraits, landscapes, and still lifes for domestic settings and corporate clients alike. These include what was considered to be fashionable fare, such as the portraits which hang in the Malta Chamber of Commerce in Valletta. Curator Dennis Vella, his extensive research into 20th century art in Malta's situation shows how the pre-war situation of modern art was very inadequately and inaccurately represented in the collection of the Valletta Museum, being largely confined to post-impressionist decorative and genre painting by good Italian artists, however, whose idiom was already 50 years out of date. The post-war years in Malta continued to reflect a general incomprehension towards exciting new developments, such as, for example, the establishment of the Modern Art Group. The National Museum remained indifferent to these movements. Significant purchases from imported Maltese contemporary artists began in the mid-60s, coinciding with a resurgence in Maltese art spurred by the achievement of independence. I'll be talking about that shortly. Up until the Second World War, an Anglophile like Edward Kawana Dingley, head of the newly formed School of Art, sent his pupils on scholarships to Rome, considered as the artistic center of excellence. And it was only after the end of the war that young artists started to exhibit diversity as a consequence of their having studied elsewhere. Thus, the years immediately following the Second World War were effectively the rupture necessary for the start of what may be considered a Maltese modernity, particularly the visual arts. The post-war years saw artists knowingly divesting themselves of the Roman influence, with some even changing their names from the Italianized Giovanni to the Anglicized John, the Giuseppe to Joseph. Artists like Antoine Camilleri, Frank Portelli, and Esprit Barthé studied in Paris, London, and New York, and returned to form the Modern Art Circle in 1952. The next defining moment was the attainment of independence in 1964. Independence led to the creation of a number of corporate entities that had not existed before. One of the most relevant and influential institutions in the establishment and assertion of statehood was the Central Bank of Malta, that was indirectly a catalyst in the establishment of corporate art collections. The architect Richard England, commissioned to design the new premises of the Central Bank, astutely put together a collection of works by modernist Maltese artists, who may now be considered to have started acquiring a veneer of respectability. In the 1990s, when England designed the central bank's annex, he commissioned work from a new generation of artists, including Antoine Camilleri and Isabel Borch. Richard England was also behind the Barclays Bank art collection, and he moreover introduced the History of Art program to the University of Malta to give his architectural students a basic grounding in art. The post-independence period also saw the establishment of government ministries and Maltese embassies, whose office walls needed to be decorated with Maltese art. Mario Zarafa, former curator of the Fine Arts and later director of the museum's department, began loaning out artworks from the museum's reserve collection. This meant that a great deal of safe and establishment art found its way to various ministries and embassies. When the museum's reserve collection of loan-worthy paintings ran out, modern artists' work was sent out, and this was not always considered to be museum quality. Independence brought about a speedy increase of state educational provision, as well as an exponential growth of tourism and a concomitant economic boom, especially in the manufacturing and building industries. Isabel Borch and Paul Clough have shown how patronage of the arts began to see a shift from the church to wealthier entrepreneurs. At this point in time, a shift from establishment themes in art to more of an artist's art is evident. This involved a progression towards a more personal and expressive art. That is a very good example. Wayne described this development as an evolution of modernist art to a postmodernism which is not here understood as a total apocalyptic break with modernity. So there is the continuity. Wayne's analysis of the position and import of abstract art in the second half of the last century is interesting for the issues that it treats, but even more interesting for the issues that it does not treat. For example, the lack of political and social engagement of Maltese visual artists during the 60s to the late 90s contrasts heavily with what was happening in Maltese theater at the time. The situation of the arts after independence, and especially during the socialist governments between 1971 and 1987, merits an in-depth analysis on its own. And I will end my presentation by posing a few reflections here. How had the situation regarding freedom of expression during the Mintoff years impacted the arts, and particularly the visual arts? Although there was no equivalent of an Entartete Kunst at the Degenerate Art exhibition, it was clear that funds were directed towards safe hagiographic art, very much on a propagandistic Soviet realist model. Maltese academic interest in the arts is relatively recent, starting in 1989 with the establishment of the History of Art Department at the University of Malta. Even then, the curriculum avoided 20th century art, until around 1992, when the artist lecturer Isabel Borch started to deliver lectures in modernism. In the mid-2000s, the BEduc art course improved matters with the inclusion of modern art as part of the syllabus. While there is a relatively modest published overview of 20th century Maltese art and artists by, amongst others, artists and academic Joseph Polkassar and academic and critic Kenneth Wayne, critical academic appraisal of the contemporary art practice in Malta is still a rather new discipline. The notable exceptions are Rafael Vella and Vince Briffa's commentaries, articles and publications, and especially their curatorial initiatives. One outcome of the lack of academic appraisal is that much pioneering work and unconventional work, including digital and performance pieces from the 1950s to the 1990s by artists of the modern art circle and even later, contemporary artists such as Austin Camilleri and the early works of Pier Portelli, have not been recorded, critiqued, and archived. Several Maltese artists have the personal records of those times, but there is a lack of cohesion and continuity. A recent shift in the artistic environment, mainly due to Malta's entry into the European Union, resulted in the return of more artists who had been training in accredited art institutions to take up posts at the University of Malta and the Malta College of Art, Science and Technology. Although there is room for optimism, it still remains to be evidenced in a corpus of published work.
Restoring has been going on for a long time, and in fact, the history of conservation in Malta has not been written yet. We are not the only ones who have not written it, because all over the world you find that the whole history of restoration has not been written, and mostly it's because there are no records. But in a way there are, and this is, you can only see them by going through the things which have been restored. And you'll find, I've seen some old restorations where they have withstood the test of time. So although they might not have used modern conservation methods that we are using today, we cannot really dismiss them completely as uneducated interventions, because they were. But perhaps the person who has, I feel, is the most important person, who I feel is the father of modern conservation methods, is Vincenzo Bonello. And I would like to quote what he had written about the training of restorers. He says, "It is not the artistic ability that counts in the training of restorers, but chemistry, literary culture, mechanical ability, and above all, the keen, passionate, and thorough knowledge of all that pertains to the old master." And when you think that this was written in 1934, that's seeing quite the future there. And I feel that if he had the opportunity to continue more and to have done more, I'm sure would have been better off. Unfortunately, although he did a lot of work, and he did probably document some things, because you can see that in some cases he put his name at the back of a painting, but I don't know if there are any notes which he has left. I haven't seen them myself. But he was a very important restorer, in my opinion. During his period, I'm sure he must have met very important people in the field of restoration. One of them is Plenderlit. Plenderlit was the one who, he's in Malta here, and he was the one who wrote The Conservation of Antiquities. Now it's a very old and outdated book, but it was quite the handbook of the time. And in fact, every library worth its foot had to have this book in its collection. So in those days, a lot of things were being done. And I think Vincenzo Bonello was the very first person who considered the object and wanted to study the object. I go fast forward, and before I go fast forward, I have to mention this person. He is Don Mauro Nguanes. He is quite a, in my opinion, quite an enigmatic figure, because he was a very erudite person. He was, as you know, the librarian who saved the Monte Cassino Library. He came to Malta as a librarian, and he did restoration of books. Unfortunately, his interventions are not very happy interventions. I still don't understand why he did what he did, because he had a lot of experience with very rare books and rare bindings, and yet he, I don't want to denigrate the person because he had his own ideas, but he was quite an enigmatic. I still would like to understand him someday. Going to the National Library, I think the National Library is is a success and failure story in itself. The library, since I was there, we opened a restoration lab. We did preservation activities such as firefighting systems, and yet at the present moment, the library is in a sorry state. And I think it is because it is based too much on the individual and there's no structures, as Charles has mentioned. And in fact, I used to call the National Library the penitentiary of the civil service, because anybody who misbehaved was sent to the National Library, and because we had long hours until 6. And so although a lot of money has been pumped into conservation and preservation, and yet it is still lacking very much behind in lots of things. The staff is weak, the structure is weak, although there is still the restoration lab and they're doing some good work, I think, but they are not following modern conservation methods, and I don't think they are doing any documentation of what they are doing, which is an unfortunate thing. In fact, this is the first book restoration lab that we had established in 1980. The people in the picture are all dead, except me who took the photo. I'm still here. And then we moved from there to another place which was much better. But the trouble with the lab in those days was there was too much of a physical divide between us and the National Library. We are not in the same place. I was not considered part of the decision-making team. I was there to give a service, so you restore the book and just leave us in peace. I should have been part of that. And even that is still happening now. The librarians sometimes have different ideas about books. We look at the book physical, whilst librarians tend to look at the content of the book. I'm saying this, it is changing and it's changing slowly.
Smajtu 50 u waħda. Program fuq Campus FM miġjub lilkom mill-Malta Historical Society. Presentazzjoni, produzzjoni, Sergio Grech.